So I will now introduce the panel. Each member of the panel will give some opening remarks that I think will focus on, how robust, how complete, how sufficient is this analytical framework that Paul laid out, and potentially offer alternatives or additional considerations that the agency needs to take account of. So I've already introduced Susan and Paul. Lena Kahn is on the panel. She is presently a fellow at Columbia University Law School. John Newman is an assistant professor at the University of Memphis School of Law. Bill Rogerson is the Charles and Emma Morrison Professor of Economics at Northwestern University. Steve Tadellis, who's been on a panel earlier in this three-day set of hearings, is a professor of economics, business, and public policy at the University of California, Berkeley Haas School of Business. And Will Tom is a partner at Morgan Lewis. There's more information on their bios or background on the web. Right now, I'll turn it over to Lena to begin, and we'll go right down the row. We'll give Susan and Paul a chance to respond, and then we'll have each panelist respond to each other. And of course, we'll take some questions from the audience.
Great, thank you. Thank you to the FTC for inviting me and to OPP for putting these together. I know it's taken a lot of work. So I'm going to discuss potential competition in the context of digital markets, specifically discussing how safeguarding potential competition in these markets is especially important. There's been significant debate in the last few years about the growing dominance of a small number of tech platforms and the role they now play as key arteries of commerce and communications. I think a key fissure in that debate is whether any of the dominant platforms are already using their dominance in ways that undermine competition, such that it should be within the purview of the antitrust laws. I think wherever you fall within that debate, steps taken by these firms to solidify their positions through eliminating future challengers should pose a huge concern to everybody. That is, even if you believe that the current dominance of these firms is nothing to worry about because we're gonna see the inexorable forces of creative destruction swoop in and dislodge their dominance, that can only be true if tomorrow's innovators are not blocked by today's incumbents. So in light of this, I think preventing mergers that entrench the positions of leading incumbent tech firms by eliminating future challengers should be a key priority for the antitrust agencies. When thinking about potential competition challenges, I think there are a few areas that deserve significant attention. One is entry barriers. So entry barriers are important to this analysis because, as we heard from Paul, the potential competition framework includes an analysis of whether there are some limits on the entrants that are positioned to enter. In digital markets, data and analytics capabilities can be a significant barrier to entry. Some would argue that aggregation of data does not pose a competition problem because data are non-rivalrous. But I think in practice, data that is significant for competition purposes might be costly and difficult to obtain, so there's going to be little incentive to share. This is not new to the FTC. The FTC recognized that data can serve as a significant entry barrier. So in the Nielsen Arbitron case, it determined that proprietary data held by the firms would be key inputs for downstream services that were still nascent, and the consent order included divestiture of certain data assets. I think another reason that it's important to consider the role of data as a barrier is that data advantages can be self-reinforcing, which means that for a new entrant, gathering enough data to contest an incumbent will be a significant challenge. So what does this mean for potential competition analysis? I think the fact that data does serve as an entry barrier suggests that in many digital markets, there will be a significant limit on the potential entrants, which is what renders potential competition analysis so salient. And by extension of that, because potential competitors are less likely to emerge, it is especially crucial that when they do emerge, antitrust safeguards that potential competition. So second challenge is what I call the Anavo problem. So Anavo is a company that Facebook acquired in 2013. It's a VPN provider that grants users heightened security, but it also allows Facebook to track in extremely close detail which rival apps are diverting attention from Facebook, which means that Facebook can detect at the very earliest stages of a company's growth which competing apps might pose competitive threats. This information then shapes Facebook's acquisition strategy and enables it to purchase apps at the very earliest stages, such as TBH and Moves, which it presumably identified as quickly growing. So Anavo is one example of the significant information asymmetries that exist between platform intermediaries and enforcers for whom the competitive significance of a deal may be less obvious if it doesn't have access to the same granular information about the usage level of rival apps. And so I think this means that agencies should be more willing to issue second requests for even seemingly small acquisitions, and then make sure that information collected in second requests include competitive intelligence gathered through devices like Anavo. I think it also means that there may be acquisitions that don't significantly undermine competition in the relevant market, but that do structurally position the incumbent to detect nascent rivals much earlier, information that they can then go and use out to make early acquisitions. And so I think these acquisitions that don't affect the relevant market but do structurally improve the position of an incumbent to make early acquisitions is something that should also be relevant to the agencies. I want to quickly address two arguments that are sometimes made to caution against aggressive enforcement in these markets. So one is the idea that there's a risk of short-term immediate consumer harm, given that an incumbent that acquires a startup may offer the quickest path to market. I think that's a very reasonable consideration. I think business literature and experience suggests that while incumbents may be more successful at delivering innovation that continues on established research paths, it's really the startups and the new firms that are more likely to account for the truly breakthrough paradigm-shifting innovations. This is for at least two reasons. One is that incumbents may not be eager to invest in innovations that are likely to lose them value on their existing investments. And the second is that even in instances when it's incumbents that are making the breakthrough innovations, in order for them to do that, they need some outside competitive pressure. So even if there is some short-term consumer harm here, I think we need to be careful about weighing that against the long-term gains in innovation. The second argument that's sometimes made is that aggressive enforcement could result in a negative effect on the capital markets for startups. If acquisition by an incumbent is an exit strategy that's motivating startup funding, then limiting these acquisitions could lead to fewer startups. I think that's also a very fair argument, but it's somewhat incomplete. I think new research by Ian Hathaway and Hal Singer shows that venture capital, first financing, and seed stage activity is contracting more rapidly or growing more slowly in sectors where, say, Facebook, Google, and Amazon are likely to enter, corroborating the kill zone story that we've heard reported other places. So I think concerns about declines in venture capital are very legitimate, but so far there are other sources of that decline. And I guess I'll close by identifying a few paths forward for the agencies that could help address concerns about potential competition. So one is, as Paul also mentioned, more merger retrospectives. Merger enforcement, of course, is ripe with uncertainty. And as merger enforcement has become much more fact-specific, oftentimes the information that's most relevant won't be available for a few years after the merger has been consummated. And if that's the case, I think it makes sense to do more merger retrospectives to identify when acquisitions did, in fact, stifle important competition and learn from that and consider undoing those mergers. And the second is to review acquisitions by monopolistic firms as potential Section 2 violations. So this is something that former Commissioner McSweeney also proposed, and there's precedent for this. So in 2017, the FTC challenged the Mallinckrodt ADR's acquisition of certain assets from Novartis under Section 2 on the theory that this acquisition was a defensive move to extinguish a nascent competitive threat to its monopoly. The settlement, therefore, involved a license to third parties to develop the relevant assets. And so this didn't involve a digital market, but I think it is a good model for how the agencies might consider evaluating acquisitions by dominant firms. So I'll close there. I think generally, antitrust has been haunted by this fear of false positives, and I think in the context of potential competition, we should be rebalancing towards more comfort with false positives, with the recognition that oftentimes that's necessary in order to prevent false negatives. So I'll leave it there.
Okay. Thank you, Lena. You can applaud. I didn't mean to get in the way. Thank you. We'll turn to John now.
All right, so I'm going to start off by, thank you, making a claim that I think would have been really uncontroversial 5 years ago. It's starting to feel a little risque, though, these days. And that is that our current basic legal framework, at least as applied to sort of core issues like horizontal mergers and acquisitions, is not totally broken. So How do I base that claim? I'd say that we can look at the types of cases that agencies have been bringing. And I'm going to focus on digital markets since a lot of the talk about nascent competition has to do with digital spaces. The agencies have been bringing a surprisingly broad variety of cases, different types of cases in different digital markets, along a spectrum, right? So you had FanDuel DraftKings, where there were two actual competitors that were merging. You had CDK Automate, where you had an actual rival merging with a sort of nascent rival. And then you had Nielsen Arbitron, which was a combination of two potential competitors, neither of which competed in the relevant market of concern at the time of the challenge. None of these cases attracted a deluge of criticism. So to me, that tells me two things. The agency is being active, and they're not making egregious mistakes. So if the basic legal framework seems to be functioning fairly well, are there nonetheless some sorts of areas that are voids in the current enforcement regime? And another way to put that question is to say, what's prompting all the calls that we're seeing for stronger antitrust enforcement in digital markets? To me, there is a big gaping void in the current framework, and that has to do with zero price markets. So none of those cases I just mentioned involved zero price markets, despite the near ubiquity of that model, at least with consumer-facing platforms. So none of these cases involved a zero price market. A lot of people have responded to that void in enforcement by urging a focus on data extraction or big data. To me, that's misguided for a bunch of reasons, the biggest of which, though, is that data extraction is just a really messy thing from a consumer perspective. So a lot of data extraction, when it's used internally by a firm to improve the product, is good for consumers. And the concerning usage, that is, you know, extracting data and then selling it to third parties who then target consumers with advertisements or using it to target advertisements, that really reflects derived demand. So the demand for data here is derived from the demand for advertising, right? The demand for attention. So to me, the core area of concern and where there seems to be a void in current enforcement structures and efforts lies around attention markets, attention competition. So my proposal is that where we see acquisitions of direct rivals, even if they're nascent, we should be looking harder to protect attention rivalry. Cases in the past that seem to, in retrospect, maybe represent false negatives would include mergers like Facebook, Instagram, Google, Waze, Zillow, Trulia, cases where attention rivalry is at the core of the merger. So that immediately runs into, I think, a laundry list of objections. A couple of them were ably addressed by Lena. A couple more. Objection number one, I'll see if I can respond to this. So all digital firms compete for our eyeballs, so they all operate from an attention perspective in one big market that's really unconcentrated. I think that totally misses the mark. So attention is the currency in these markets. So the objection is essentially the exact equivalent of saying all firms compete for money, so there must be one big market that's really unconcentrated. Just laughable. Second objection, we already look at harm to innovation on the user side, the zero price side, the attention rivalry side of a lot of platforms. This is true, or it seems to be true at least, if you look at something like Zillow Trulia. The agency reported that it looked for harm to innovation on the user side of the platform. Is that enough, though? Is that sufficient to allay all concerns or find all concerns? I don't think so. Unfortunately, we don't have, as we've heard today, a really strong economic theory or econometric tools that we can use to assess innovation effects in a merger context. And to worsen the problem, the qualitative evidence that we would usually rely on in the absence of a nice economic theory is not likely going to be there. So if we think about what we'd be looking for, it'd be maybe a board presentation, right? Where a CEO is trying to sell an acquisition to the board by saying, oh, after the merger, we're not going to innovate anymore. Never going to happen. So the types of qualitative evidence we would need isn't going to be there, I think, in a lot of cases. So focusing solely on harm to innovation in these contexts is not going to be enough to catch all the potential anti-competitive effects. Finally, I think, and this is maybe the most salient or the most trenchant criticism of the idea of regulating attention markets in a more interventionist way, is that market definition, market effects are going to be really hard to measure here. Right? We lack prices, and that's our favorite tool to use. here, I think there actually will be useful qualitative evidence that we could use. So if you go back and look at investor statements from Zillow Trulia, to use one example, post-acquisition, you've got the CEO of Zillow Group saying in an investor call, a publicly available call, that now we've got 70-plus percent of the market for online real estate portals. That's pretty compelling. It's qualitative, right? But it's pretty compelling stuff. And if that's the kind of stuff that's available publicly, one can only imagine what's being said internally. Second, quantitative evidence. And here's where I'd like to sort of urge the FTC to look harder in a specific way. With digital firms in particular, there is often a great deal of A-B testing that goes on in the marketplace. It's really easy to do that in a digital market. To the extent that the FTC could ask for the results of A-B testing when firms are changing advertising loads and looking at the competitive results of that, I think that would be a fantastic idea and would help give us an idea of what happens in a digital market when a dominant firm increases advertising loads to users. Where does that substitution go to? It could be a really useful tool for us to use.
Okay, thank you, John. We will turn to Bill Rogerson now.
Great. Well, thank you very much for having me here today, and thanks for doing such a great job organizing this very timely conference. My understanding is the first panel is supposed to focus on two questions. First, what framework should we use to evaluate mergers between incumbents and nascent competitors in high-tech industry? And second, is the current law and the current version of the merger guidelines consistent with using the correct framework, or would the law or the guidelines have to be changed or altered in order to use the correct framework? I'm going to focus more on the first question of what the correct framework should be, because I think this is a question that economics can shed the most light on, and I'm an economist. However, let me very briefly say regarding the second question that I agree with a lot of what has been said earlier, that I view the law and the merger guidelines as relatively general statements, flexible general statements of general principles that are pretty sensible. And my own non-lawyer view of it is that one could interpret existing law and the existing merger guidelines as being completely consistent with a sensible and correct welfare analysis of the problem. So I don't think there's any need to change the law or even to change the merger guidelines. I think all the right principles are in place. If I was on the next panel that's supposed to address should we get a little tougher on any mergers, or have we been looking at these mergers as carefully as we ought to using the correct framework, I'd probably say, given the events I've seen in the last 5 years, looking back on them, that possibly regulators should be a little tougher or look more closely at a number of mergers. And perhaps there have been a number of mergers that have been approved that, at least in retrospect, with hindsight, one wonders why they were approved or whether they really should have been or whether there was enough evidence at the time to decide that perhaps that they shouldn't go forward with. But I don't think there's really any need for a change in the law, and I think the basic elements of the correct framework are in place. What I'm going to do today is focus on one specific issue related to what the right approach is, and what I'm going to do is describe two different social welfare problems that we could attempt to solve when we were choosing a policy on how to evaluate these types of mergers. The first policy is going to be not quite correct and be extremely complicated. The second policy is going to be exactly correct and fantastically more complicated than the extremely complicated policy. And one message I want to leave you with today is that I wonder whether or not we should be considering using the not quite correct policy, because it's a type of question, the type of welfare evaluation, although it's extremely complicated, I could imagine evidence being brought to it and evaluated. Whereas the second perfectly correct question, I'm not so sure this is the case. Okay. So let me start, just as a benchmark, with describing what I think the standard competition problem is when two mature firms come to the DOJ or the FTC and say, we'd like to merge. Okay. Because they're, you know, and of course, we really just look at the try and assess the competitive effects of the merger, see to what extent it would cause competition would be reduced and price would go up, quality would go down, or perhaps even look at innovation effects on the one hand, and then on the other hand, ask if there are compensating efficiencies and try and do some sensible analysis as best we can to predict whether or not consumer welfare would be higher or lower with the merger. Okay? Now, what changes when one mature firm and a nascent competitor come to the agencies and say, we'd like to merge? So we have a big incumbent who wants to merge with a startup that has created a new idea. So it's already been in the market for a while, thinking, doing innovation. It's created the idea for a new product. Perhaps it's already begun to introduce it to the market, but there's still a lot of uncertainty. Maybe the product is still going to evolve. It isn't quite clear how consumers will use it or how many consumers will want to use it or whether they'll view it as a substitute for the incumbent's product or not, or to what extent they'll view it as a substitute. So there's a huge amount of uncertainty about exactly how this nascent product will fit into the market. Well, I think there are two different welfare problems you could consider when you are asking, should we approve this merger? Okay. The first one I'm going to call the ex post problem. And the reason I call it the ex post problem is I'm going to say, let's take as given that we have that startup today who's already done all of the startup innovation that he did. He's already come up with a new idea, tried it out a little bit in practice, and he's ready to go. Or, you know, he's nascent, but he's done a lot of work already. He's already done this preliminary innovation. Okay. Well, at that point, taking that as given, the competition problem we're looking at with the mature firm and the nascent firm is very similar to the problem we look at with the two mature firms, only there's a lot more uncertainty about exactly what the competitive effects are and what the nature of the efficiencies are. Right? But in principle, it's the same type of problem. We've got two firms. We want to assess the competitive effects. It's going to be harder to do this because it's more forward-looking, relying on more predictions. We're not quite sure if the start, you know, what number one, would the startup succeed if it was by itself? Or really, has it only come up with an idea that would be useful for an incumbent firm? And perhaps it was never even really trying to think of a standalone idea. Really, perhaps the efficient way to organize innovation in this industry was simply that little startups think of new ideas that existing incumbents are better at implementing. So that could be what's going on. Or on the other hand, it could well be an idea that could grow into a new product that really would challenge the rival. Okay, but it's uncertain. So if we went ahead and did this analysis, we'd still try and determine whether consumer surplus will be higher or lower with or without the merger, but there's going to be more uncertainty. So it's going to be a much harder problem and maybe harder to draw the conclusion that the merger will be bad. On the one hand, if we allow the merger, the incumbent firm will get this technology and use it in some sense, although we don't even really know how the incumbent firm will use it. Okay? If we disallow the merger, it's possible the startup will just go down the drain. Or it's possible if the startup survives, the product still won't be nearly as good as if the talented incumbent who knows how to implement a new product had taken it over. On the other hand, the startup might succeed beautifully, and we'd not only have the product available to consumers, but we'd have more competition, and everyone would be better off. So there's a lot of uncertainties, but nonetheless, it's fundamentally the same problem. Two firms have walked up to you, and you have to say, will consumer surplus be higher if I allow the merger, or I don't allow the merger? Okay, so that's what I'm calling the ex post problem. It's a slightly more complicated version of the too mature firms problem. Okay, but the point I want to leave you with, or the point I want to stress here, is that ex post problem isn't necessarily the theoretically right problem to be considering. Okay, why is that? What is the ex post problem ignoring? Well, the ex post problem is saying, I already have this startup. Now should I let him be bought or not? He's already done his innovation, and now what should I do with him? Okay? If you were really setting a merger policy in the real world, surely you'd like to take, or potentially, you'd want to take into account the fact that when I choose a merger policy, I'm going to make startup innovation more or less profitable for startups. In particular, if I make it easier for incumbents to buy startups, doing startup innovation will be more profitable, and there's likely to be more startup innovation. And in fact, if it turns out that this is one of those industries where the efficient way to organize innovation is to let little guys think of new ideas and then big guys implement them, I might be getting in the way of just the efficient way of doing R&D and innovation in this industry if I started blocking a lot of these mergers, because they wouldn't do them, startups wouldn't do them in the first place if they couldn't sell their product to the incumbent. Well, I could consider that problem too, and I could call that the ex ante problem. Right, looking at the effects of the policy before startups have done their innovation. Now, I'd still want to answer the first question of, given this merger with this startup, will consumer surplus go up or down if I allow the merger? But that might not be the end, right? Although I haven't yet worked this out in a formal model, if we wrote down the formal model in a well-behaved model, we would predict that the fully optimal solution might be to be a little more lenient on mergers than the one that just implemented perfectly efficient ex post policies. And that's because innovation is generally good for consumers. So it might be desirable, at least in theory, to commit to a policy where you purposely commit to approving some mergers that are inefficient ex post in order to create better innovation incentives ex ante. Okay. Now, the second problem, the ex ante problem, is the perfectly correct problem. Okay. But it's a complete order of magnitude harder than the ex post problem, which is already a complete order of magnitude harder than the standard problem. Usually, when I hear experts on existing antitrust laws kind of get into the details of how they would analyze an actual merger between an actual incumbent and an actual startup, they do some version of what I would call describing the ex post problem. That is, I think they try and ask the question, this is hard to do, but I'm going to ask, would consumers be better off if I allowed this merger? And they really don't consider the issue of what effect will this have on innovation incentives of startups going forward. I think that might be the right idea. I'm not sure, but I want to submit to you that this might not be a bad idea for two different reasons. I think that it's possible that this ex post problem is a problem that's simple enough that courts could actually evaluate it. And if you ask courts to evaluate problems where there's just going to be completely no factual basis for arriving at any sort of possible reasonable conclusion, you're just inviting them to give their own opinion. And so it might be best to restrict us to a fairly good question that they really can potentially answer that's going to rely on some objective facts that can be presented before the court. The second thing is, I'm not sure the two problems would necessarily yield that different an answer anyhow. I think if you've got a correct ex post policy, you're still going to allow plenty of mergers where the mergers would have never had any hope, really, of launching a separate firm. They're really just little ideas that the incumbent would have used anyhow. And if you apply that policy sensibly, I think you're going to allow a lot of these mergers, and there still will be good merger incentives. And secondly, there's a countervailing effect. If you loosen up your merger policy to get the startups to invest more, the incumbent is going to invest less, and that's going to be bad. So there's a countervailing effect if you try and loosen up policy away from the efficient policy, trying to get more mergers, more innovation. It just may be that the incumbent will frustrate you by investing less. So on balance, I'm not sure that the slightly easier problem isn't that bad a problem in any event. And at a minimum, I think it's a problem that courts could potentially address. Maybe the way this really would work out in practice, often in real cases, people always talk about what's the probability that we have to show that the startup would succeed? How high does that probability have to be? How certain do we have to be that the firm would survive by itself and actually be a good competitor? Right? Maybe in a theoretical world, you could think of, well, there'd be a level to set that probability at that produced efficient decisions, ex post efficient decisions, and maybe you want to move it around a tiny bit if you were trying to do this fully optimal problem, even though no one knows how to do that. Okay? And I might imagine that the real problem that courts and enforcers will always think of themselves as solving is they take that probability as given, whatever it seems to be given the case law, and then they just try and investigate whether the merger is ex post efficient or not. Over time, through some mysterious process that lawyers know about, courts maybe end up doing the right thing, even though it's hard to calculate what that is. I have no idea. But I would submit that it might make sense for us to focus on this slightly simpler, incorrect problem, even though it is incorrect.
Okay. Thank you, Bill. I think this is the second panel I've moderated, and I think what people may discover is I'm not a very good disciplinarian. So I've envisioned this panel as sort of setting up the next two panels, so I have allowed people to go a little bit over allocated time. But one thing I do want to do is after Steve and Will, give Paul and Susan a chance to respond. So just keep that in mind as you do your comments. So we'll turn it over to Steve and then Will.
Thank you, Bilal, and thanks to the FTC for having this. I'm also grateful that I'm actually speaking, because the way things were going, that was uncertain. Like Bill, I do believe that the current welfare analysis is the preferred tool, not surprisingly. I'm an economist. But I think these tools need to be carefully applied, because one thing that isn't said enough is that not all platforms are created equally. They don't all have the same business model. They don't all have the same barriers to entry. So there's a lot of discussion that people seem to lump together. I heard this earlier. Oh, the Google, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, right? These are all different companies, different business models, and the devil's in the details. And I think that's something that is not said enough, which is why I wanted to start with that. Now going to a broad theoretical perspective, there's no question that nascent competition is something we appreciate because of two main influences it has. One, it keeps companies a check in terms of pricing. And second, it's a great source of innovation. Now, the first is non-controversial. You know, without competition, dominant firms might take advantage of the market, price higher, produce less quantity. That's an easy one. The innovation thing is not as easy. So going back to 1962, Ken Arrow, a very celebrated economist, suggested that competitive markets are really what is needed for innovation. The reason being that in a competitive market, if you manage to innovate, get a slight cost advantage or a slight quality advantage, then you're going to gain a lot of market share from the rest of the competitors, and that gives you a tremendous amount of incentives to innovate. 20 years earlier, Joseph Schumpeter, another celebrated economist, said something very different. that in the long run, competitive markets do not provide true returns or super normal returns, and hence there's not much reason to innovate. You actually need market power in order to get the gains from innovation and to have those incentives in place. And there have been a lot of studies, not enough maybe, to try to tease this apart. A recent, very celebrated article in the Quarterly Journal of Economics, which is one of the leading journals in economics, suggested that there is an inverse U-shape relationship between competition and innovation, namely some kind of Goldilocks story. Too little is not good, too much is not good, some healthy middle appears. Now, I was very happy that Paul mentioned we should encourage our graduate students to work on this topic. As it so happens, one of my graduate students who is on the job market this year has written a beautiful paper where he did something akin to retrospective analysis, which is not easy to do, spent a year and a half gathering data where he took data from the DOJ's cartel breakup history, which clearly was an exogenous shock to competition, because one of the things we worry about and the reason empirical work is so difficult here is that competition and innovation are both determined not only by the relationship between them, but by what we call latent or lurking variables. And it's really hard to tease that causation correlation story. So what he did, he went back 30 years, collected data of breakups in different markets, defined the market carefully, treatment control. Obviously, like any study, there are some assumptions. But what he showed is actually that more competition creates less innovation measured by patent investment filings, by patent breadth, and by R&D investments. So I think the verdict is out about what is the right amount of competition and, by extension, nascent competition in order to get innovation from the theory side. Now let me turn a bit to practice, because in theory there's no difference between theory and practice, but in practice there is. And I was inspired by Susan and a handful of other economists who actually spend time in industry. I spent 2 years at eBay building and leading a team of economists. I spent a year at Amazon also leading a team of economists and kind of, you know, seeing how things actually work. And their relationship with startups and innovation more broadly. Now, startups are the source of this nascent competition that we're talking about here, and the reason startups are created is because the founders and the people who invest in them believe that they will get returns in the future. No returns, no investment. That's kind of straightforward. And startups are uncertain. You know, I'm again echoing something that Bill said. There is a lot of uncertainty in these innovative endeavors. So we need to focus on what differentiates success from failures when we think about startups who engage in investment. So first of all, it could be bad products. Now, by and large, we believe that venture capital financing and other financing are going to be a pretty strong gateway. You know, stupid product, I'm not going to give you money. Of course, think Theranos, and you might think differently. But by and large, that is one mechanism in place. You might have a good product. You start investing. You need to acquire customers. That's something that Susan spoke about at length. If you don't have enough money to engage in marketing to get your customers, or the marketing costs are a lot more than you thought they would be, you might burn all your investment capital and then die, not because you have a bad product, but because you didn't manage to get that early start, the so-called chicken and egg problem. Last but not least is poor execution. And I can't stress enough how many companies fail because of poor execution, something that, as an academic, I never appreciated. It's like, oh, here's the model. In theory, it works. What's the big deal? Well, again, in practice, things are very different. And this is precisely where acquisition exits have a tremendous amount of value. Again, I'm echoing something that Bill said. Because execution is so difficult, it is those large companies who succeeded time and again who have put together the apparatus that helps with execution, and that is complementary to the success of many of these startups. So if we go to that question, kind of like that ex post idea that Bill promoted, we have to ask ourselves, if we allow this merger to happen, what will probabilistically happen in the future? And are there real barriers to entry for future competition that might be foreclosed if we allow certain mergers to happen? And in platform markets, which is really what we're talking about here, those barriers to entry are primarily about indirect network effects, and those are going to be a barrier if, one, multi-homing is costly, and again, Susan talked about multi-homing a lot, and two, acquiring new customers is difficult, which again, Susan mentioned at length. And these are tightly connected because if multi-homing is easy, acquiring customers is easy. So my observations from my experience on the tech sector more broadly, but especially retail marketplaces, since everybody else ignored the Time's Up sign, I might do that too, but don't worry, Will.
I'm the competitor waiting in the wings.
I know. Then first of all, for many products and services, multi-homing requires two or three clicks and two queries. So whenever I choose to buy something, within less than 2 minutes, I could compare Amazon, eBay, and Walmart. And I often do if it's a more expensive product. And truth be told, if it's a $12 product, I'm not going to bother because if I'm screwed by 40 cents, that's okay. I could live with that. And again, every time I do those comparisons, I find the prices to be extremely similar. Second, every time I take a ride, I have Uber and Lyft on my phone right next to each other. In 45 seconds, I will have that price comparison and time comparison. Sometimes I'm in more of a hurry and I will pay a dollar more to get there faster. Sometimes I'll rather save that dollar and wait another few minutes. Then the second thing is that early stage entry has become extremely cheap and very easy to do, precisely because of a lot of platforms that came up like cloud computing services. What used to be a capital expenditure buying millions of dollars of servers is now pay-as-you-go computing and storage. And that makes the early stages of entry very, very easy. And here I'm echoing something that Lena said. Barriers to entry are really critical to look at. And for startups in the tech sector, barriers to entry in early stages have declined dramatically. Last but not least, VC funding is really thirsty for potential entrants. One example is Jet.com. 4 years ago, the company was founded. They raised close to $1 billion in venture funding, and shortly after that, they were bought by Walmart.com, and now they are driving most of Walmart's online platform. So going to another point that Lena mentioned, and she quoted Hal Singer from the previous panel, who mentioned this decline in VC funding. Well, there's a study by Oliver Wayman, albeit funded by Facebook, so full disclosure, that's what I read, but it shows that VC funding is at records high. What has changed is where the VC funding is coming in. Rather than coming in at early stages, it is now coming in at later stages of investment. Well, if you think about the reduction in barriers to entry to start a startup, that makes complete sense. That is a market reaction. Easy to enter, hard to execute, so VCs come in into that later execution phase. So I'm going to conclude quickly with 3 points. So first, I am convinced that the current tools, guided by solid economic thinking and those that guide empirical analysis, are adequate to deal with the topic that we're talking about today. Second, as we move forward, I think we really have to be careful to do things on a case-by-case basis. There is no one-size-fits-all tool or application. And in that respect, and this is, again, something that Lena mentioned, I am a huge fan of retrospective analysis, and I wish we did more of it. I don't think we're doing enough of that retrospective analysis. Government agencies that have amazing data when they evaluate mergers could be a wonderful source for that kind of analysis. Last but not least, I think that evidence suggests that in these so-called platform markets, entry barriers are low, multi-homing is easy, nascent competition is not under threat by these acquisitions. I think, on the contrary, acquisitions help spur execution, which then lead to more opportunities for innovation. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve. So let's turn to Will.
Thanks, Bilal. I'm going to confine myself to two categories of comments, one on the nature of the tools, and the second on the management of the tools. So on the nature of the tools, I fully agree with Stephen that the tools are adequate. I think the agencies have a very full toolbox. In fact, I think the toolbox is kind of overflowing, and therein lies a risk. So I think that technical term for what has happened to the toolbox over the last couple of decades as the tools have evolved in response to changing circumstances is that the tools have become squishier. Take, for example, the temporal issues that Paul identified in terms of the 1 year, 2 year kind of thing, and the much more qualitative kinds of measures that found their way into the 2010 guidelines. I think that was an effort to avoid some of the inaccuracies of the kind of Procrustean bed of bright line rules about time periods, but you see the analog in a lot of areas besides time periods, for example, market share. So market share in vertical theories, and I think the first time this really became clear to me was in the Time Warner-Turner merger that the FTC handled more than a decade ago. And the notion that that you see in the analysis to aid public comment is that the share of foreclosure is a function of what is actually needed by the complementor. And so, you know, there the theory was the barriers that would be posed by new programming entities by control of more of the conduit. And the notion that you'll see in the analysis there was to launch a significant new program or programming network, you needed to be able to reach, you know, about 60% of the subscribers nationwide. Well, you know, the inverse of 60% is 40%. If you can foreclose 40%, that's enough. You don't need the traditional monopoly share or anything like that. And so instead of a bright line, you know, suddenly it was a measurement that depended on the circumstances of the case and the competitive theory involved. Okay. So as these tools have gotten squishier, the risk of misunderstanding has increased. And one example near and dear to my heart is innovation markets, which the a term which the 2017 IP guidelines has finally gotten rid of. Probably a good thing, even though there was nothing wrong with the underlying concept. It's just that as interpreted and applied, nobody seemed to understand what that underlying concept was. The concept came about as a direct result of the GMZF merger, in which you had two companies that barely competed at all in the downstream goods markets, just as a geographic matter. But it happened that to innovate in this product market, you needed a massive amount of manufacturing facilities. There was an iterative process between the manufacturing and the innovation, and these were the only two companies that had it. So even though they didn't compete much downstream, they competed heavily in innovation, and the benefits of that leapfrogging competition was felt worldwide, even in markets in which they did not compete in the goods markets. And so the focus of the innovation market theory was on specialized assets. So if you had a type of innovation that anybody in his garage could come up with, you really didn't worry too much about the restraint on innovation that came about from a merger, because you didn't know where the next breakthrough was going to come from. And so it didn't make sense for the antitrust enforcers to worry about. That whole case hinged on the specialized nature of the assets needed to innovate and the fact that very, very few players had it. That's you know, one set of issues that have that poses an example of the danger of the risk of misunderstanding as these concepts become more elastic. I think you know currently this notion of acquisitions of data may be another area that we really ought to think hard about before we leap at the latest, shiniest theory. I don't think these are really zero-price markets. I mean, for the most part, when you're looking at mergers of two companies with significant caches of data, you're really talking about data acquisitions as input purchases. They're getting data. Those data are useful to them in their business and helpful to them as they compete downstream. And they are paying a price to get that data. It's not a monetary price. They're paying in the form of offering consumers services. So, you know, the old joke that if you're paying a zero price, you're not the consumer, you're the product. And I think, you know, that has a lot of truth in how we ought to think about these mergers. Okay. So another point about the nature of the tools is that as these tools become squishier, if you will, the complexity of the trade-offs has increased. And, you know, the asymmetries that Paul pointed to in terms of when we look at potential entry as a potential anti-competitive harm, and when we look at potential entry as curing a harm from a merger, they're not always symmetric. And I think, you know, in some sense, they don't need to be. What you're, in a broader sense, what you're looking at is a decision theory framework, right? You know, what are the consequences of being wrong and the probabilities of being wrong? And the administrative costs of getting it righter in both dimensions. And you know, you make those trade-offs against each other, and the probabilities don't necessarily have to balance if the consequences don't balance. And so I think it's very much a case-by-case. And you know, maybe a great example of how granular those case-by-case determinations might be. You know, I was always an admirer of Chairman Norris's handling of the Genzyme case, in which he really drilled down into, you know, what are the incentives affecting the behavior of the CEO of the acquiring company. And, you know, sometimes I think you have to do that. There are harms that we have to be cognizant of in these kinds of areas where we're looking at nascent competition, and you know, to reach for a somewhat old and old technology example, Lilly Sepracor, where you know, again more than a dozen years ago. And Commissioner Anthony made some speeches about this one. You had a branded pharmaceutical company acquiring an isomer, or a company that had an isomer of its product. It appeared that the isomer was a product improvement. Some argued against the merger on the theory that Sepracor was the greatest potential competitive threat to Lilly. The problem was that this nascent competitive threat, you know, by law, would not be able to market this nascent competitive threat for 4 years because it clearly infringed Lilly's basic patent. And so, you know, I think there was a case where both the probabilities and the potential consequences weighed clearly in favor of letting the merger go through, because you know, the probabilities were, you know, weighing the near-term benefit of the greater execution and the removal of the blocking position against this somewhat theoretical benefit of the future competition 4 years from now. And the consequences of that trade-off was benefits to patients now, health benefits, versus some theoretical benefit of price competition some years down the road. So I think you need to make those trade-offs carefully. Okay, let me just turn very quickly to a couple of words about management. When I was at the commission, there was a commissioner who was very fond of behavioral economics and was an advocate of applying it at every possible turn. And I could understand how it applied to our consumer protection mission, and I never could quite get how it applied to our competition mission until it hit me one day that if you turned the telescope around and trained it on the enforcers, behavioral economics would tell you quite a bit about the cognitive biases of the people within the building who are doing these investigations and making the case recommendations and voting on the case recommendations. When it struck me, it seemed like a brilliant insight until just a couple of days ago when I was searching the web for something else and I stumbled across a really nice article written by Bill Kovacic and Jim Cooper that made exactly that point. So there's nothing new under the sun. But we should pay attention to the fact that narratives are powerful. They're especially attractive when they seem like novel insights. My feeling about, my belief that, gee, I had this brilliant idea about behavioral economics might be an example of that, where you weigh much more heavily things that are novel and exciting and fun, and you stick to them, even if a sober analysis of the potential consequences might lead you in the other direction. So that's point one on management. A second point is attitudinal approaches. Former acting chairman Olhausen has spoken a lot about regulatory humility, and that's that I think scratches the surface of what enforcers might think about as they approach some of these new complexities. I also think we should think about some process approaches to managing these tools. One thing that always struck me was there has been an unwritten rule that's grown up at the FTC about the number of meetings you get with the bureau director. And it's colloquially referred to as the one meeting rule. And I think it makes a lot of sense in traditional horizontal mergers where the volume is such that if you allowed more than one meeting, you'd never do anything else. And the analytical paths are straightforward enough that additional meetings wouldn't help very much. But in novel and cutting edge areas, I would really like to see that unwritten rule abolished. I think there's nothing worse than having the staff go down a particular route or pursue a particular hobby horse, maybe driven by some of these cognitive biases I was talking about, and work for months and months or years on a matter only to, when management finally pays attention, find that there are whole dimensions of the issue that they've overlooked. So one meeting rule, devil's advocates, I think, can be very useful and maybe ought to be formalized. People have talked about retrospectives, and I heartily endorse that, although they're highly resource intensive. All of these things, I think, become ever more important as these tools become just a little more ephemeral and difficult to follow clear and well-traveled roads. Thanks.
Okay, well, I think we are actually out of time, so I'm not going to eat into the next panel's time. So we're going to take a 10-minute break, and we'll be back here with the second panel on nascent competition.